Welcome to Voice for Choice podcast, the podcast that focuses on China issues with special attention to the Central and Eastern European perspective. I'm your host, Karanya Mečkova. Joining me today will be Emil Avdaliani. Emil is a professor at European University and the director of the Middle East Studies at the Georgian think tank, GeoCase. Hello and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Today, we will discuss Georgia's strategic partnership with China and what it means for the West. But before we get to the serious stuff, I would like to introduce my guest. How did you get to focus on China professionally?
Well, China, as a big country, as a rising power, essentially, was the state which I was interested in from my early research, especially on Silk Roads. And I think that was the time when I sort of began researching what China really wanted in ancient or medieval period, and then gradually moved to the modern period of those Silk Roads, so-called Silk Roads, involving Belt and Road Initiative. I remember well the subject, essentially, from which it all started. That was basically how medieval Georgian sources referred to China. And there were specific terms for that, and I researched a bit on that, and that led to some interesting conclusions on that regard. And that was essentially linked to the Mongols and Silk Roads, and how the Mongols connected China with Europe, and whether Silk Roads were traversing essentially Georgian territory in ancient and medieval period. And that those were the questions which essentially linked distant Georgia to China.
Yeah. At the end of July, China and Georgia announced an upgrade in bilateral relations to a strategic partnership. What will this partnership bring in material terms beyond the symbolic value?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And to be honest, we don't really have a clear answer to that. I still think that beyond those proclamatory sentences that the two countries will be sort of developing deeper and more strategic ties, we have not yet seen anything. Surely it's only almost a month since the signing of the partnership, but seeing how the things were developing over the past years, or even perhaps decade, or even more than that, you see that Chinese interests in the South Caucasus are not that big, I would say, as they have been in Central Asia or elsewhere. And I'm sure that we will touch upon the reasons behind the signing of the partnership. There could be changes into that perspective from Beijing, that the region might be sort of turning from relatively less important region for China into a very important region, actually. And there are some reasons, some hints highlighting this possible, geopolitical shift. But overall, for the moment, even though we've got this partnership, we still, it's not a guarantee that we're going to see flourishing, bilateral relations between the two countries.
Let's have a look at the recent history of the bilateral relations. How have the ties evolved since Tbilisi joined the BRI in 2016 and since Tbilisi signed FTA in 2017 with Beijing?
Yeah, well, when those two events happened, especially the free trade agreement with China from 2017, there was a, expectation essentially in Georgia and even among those scholars from the in the West, for example, who covered South Caucasus and Central Asia, arguing that we might be seeing a shift in China's perspective, and China might be in the initial stage of its geopolitical, geoeconomic expansion westward from Central Asia to the South Caucasus. But this expectation didn't really live up to, I would say, the realities on the ground didn't really live up to expectations among the politicians and analysts and scholars. Perhaps the pandemic too sort of hindered the potential development, but I would say that even before the pandemic, we saw how trade was growing, bilateral trade was growing, but it was not something staggering. Bilateral investment dynamic was not super expensive too. So we were seeing, I would say, I wouldn't say stagnation, but essentially we did not see quick development of those bilateral ties. Again, one part of the reason could have been the pandemic. The other part perhaps is more geopolitical, that the South Caucasus and Georgia essentially was mostly seen by China as a part of the so-called Russian sphere of influence, I would say, where perhaps Chinese were hesitant to make brusque moves, I would say. But overall, I think that even beyond that, the route through Russia, I mean, trade route through Russia between China and the EU served well Beijing, and there was no impetus, I would say, to shift to the south, to the South Caucasus. And in that regard, Georgia was situated on an important trade route, I would say, again, the middle corridor. But that middle corridor, I mean, before the pandemic and before Russia's invasion of Ukraine, was not that big in scope. And looking at those times, at that period from today, you see the logic behind China's behavior, I would say.
And would you say that the division of labor between China and Russia in the South Caucasus still holds even after the war?
Yeah, we usually sort of do not apply those terms to the South Caucasus, and there are even scholars who disagree with the application of this term to Central Asia. But I would say, yeah, this unwritten understanding, I would say, might be changing now following the invasion of Ukraine by Russia and shifting nature of connectivity across Eurasia. So now, indeed, as per your question, now indeed we might be seeing sort of several points where China might be really moving to make a major change in its relations with Georgia. And primary reasons surely are, again, the, I wouldn't say the end to the Russian trade route from China to the EU, but at least we see sort of decrease of throughput through Russia. And that, of course, pushes China, the EU, Turkey, and smaller countries along the middle route, middle way, or middle corridor, whatever you call it, to seek or to sort of establish an alternative, viable alternative. And indeed, if you look at the map from Xinjiang to the EU, to Romania, to Bulgaria, or to China, the middle corridor is the shortest one, geographically speaking. It's a multimodal one. It's not a very comfortable one because you have to cross, lands and roads and mountains and gorges and so on and so on. But the infrastructure is developing. It's going into the right direction, maybe slower than, than necessary, than expected. But nevertheless, you see the trend towards improvement. And perhaps that is the major reason why China is sort of looking towards Georgia from a different perspective now. But there are, I think, other reasons too. Well, Georgia sits on the comfortable, route from Black Sea to Caspian Sea to Central Asia. And you see that the Black Sea region is the region which has been volatile for, well, since the breakup of the Soviet Union. I would say that that is one of the most dynamic regions across Eurasia. Well, we surely have Middle East and South China Sea and so on, but in terms of instability, it is no less than or even more at times than Middle East. So you had civil wars in Georgia, You had Russian invasion of Georgia, Russian invasion of Ukraine from 2014, problems in Moldova. Essentially, that's the region where trade routes go through, where civil wars and interstate wars are taking place. And whoever controls the Black Sea will essentially hold the key, I wouldn't say over global geopolitical processes, but on most of them, yes, perhaps. And you see how the EU, how Russia are essentially competing with each other over who will be building a geopolitical order, and which will be essentially exclusive in nature. So I don't really think that the Russians are seeing the EU's part in the wider Black Sea region in any way. And now, following the war in Ukraine, I see that Brussels, with its expansion, gradual expansion towards the Black Sea, I think that for the EU, there is no essentially place for Russia under Putin, I would say. And so those are mutually exclusive geopolitical orders. And when China looks at that region from distance, it really wants to take part in that, I wouldn't say maybe geopolitical competition per se, definitely not military competition, but at least wants to take or sort of slightly influence the process in that region, which again serves, if even without the middle corridor, but especially with the expansion of the corridor, as a vital region where Eurasian trades flows in and out. So I think that the dynamic which we see in the Black Sea region sort of is pulling China into that region. And you also have Central Asia, and I think that you need to look at the you need to look at why China sort of is shifting its approach towards South Caucasus and especially Georgia. You need to look at that from a bit of Central Asian perspective. Central Asia is the region which China is essentially reopening, I would say, to the wider world. It might sound a bit strange, but if you look at the map there, the region was essentially for more than a century and a half being exclusively linked to Russia via infrastructure, well, even culturally and politically, and so on and so on. So this north-south connectivity is now being reshaped by China with the introduction of new east-west connectivity. And I think the tentative progress essentially on China, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan railway is really sort of highlights a new development in the region, how China is sort of opening up this relatively closed, or even I would say that very much closed region. And you see that once you are in Central Asia, and you move westward, you have to move beyond Central Asia. And the only region which would serve you in that regard is, of course, South Caucasus. Well, there was Russia, but Russia is increasingly unpredictable. And I think that when you read Chinese perspective on the war, surely for the West, it's unacceptable, the language and the terms used by the Chinese side, by the Chinese analysts, and so on and so on. But there is this feeling how unpredictable Russia is. And I think for the Chinese, it's also very critical to develop alternative trade routes, which would also lead us to a very interesting question for me as a scholar of Silk Roads, that Silk Roads were essentially always adaptive to rising challenges, to existing or again emerging opportunities. So they were never static. And I don't really think that Belt and Road Initiative 2 is static. It's sort of adaptive. It tries to adapt to new realities on the ground. And I think in that way, we might be seeing sort of the entrance of South Caucasus corridor into the Belt and Road initially laid out almost a decade ago.
are Georgia's prospects of becoming this major trade and connectivity hub? Are there some challenges? Because you mentioned that it's progressing, but maybe not as quickly as they could maybe wish for.
Well, problems are multiple, I would say, and the major one of surely is related to the inadequate state of infrastructure, essentially in here. We are still lacking a deep sea port, which is critical for establishing these cross-Eurasian trade corridors. And we also, well, the country also needs sort of better, much better railway infrastructure, road infrastructure. Again, there's progress is still, well, ongoing, I would say. The process of rebuilding or sort of improving infrastructure is ongoing. But again, it's going very slow and it will take years, if not more, to fully develop into very massive and powerful infrastructure capable of, with withstanding large amounts of throughput from Europe to China and vice versa. So I think that there are politically and on the ground, there are some positive trends, but the pace of change needs to be essentially be quicker, be high, essentially.
Going back to the impact of the war on, the bilateral relations of China and Georgia. Now, if we look at Georgia's perspective, how did the war change Tbilisi's thinking about its foreign policy strategy, about its positioning in the wider region?
The war has served essentially as a major, I would say, as a major event, not only in the region, surely in the world, but especially for Georgia, because the country is under, I would say, under pressure from Russia. Well, it's 20% of the territory are occupied by the Russian Federation. But the thinking in Georgia, well, at least in the political class, ruling political class, has been that Russia has not yet lost the war, and the West is not quickly, well, is not expanding quickly enough into the wider Black Sea region. And this dilemma, this double dilemma, I would say, how to respond to the Russian threat, especially when it's still not meaningfully defeated, I would say, in Ukraine, and how quickly could we expect EU's and NATO's expansion into the wider area, wider Black Sea area, how to reconcile all those, well, these two, I would say, challenges for Georgia. So the trauma for Georgia is surely the invasion of Russia in 2008, but I would say that the problem is not so much the war itself, but how the West reacted to the war. And of surely many Georgians are quite unhappy with the fact that after the war, just several months after several months, the West and Russia really, really managed, to sort of rebuild their ties. So Georgia was pushed aside, I would say. The problem around Georgia was pushed aside. And for Georgians, that means that essentially, we cannot really be hoping for quick military aid from the West. And at the time when Russia is so close and geographically bordering on us and essentially occupying 20%. So how could we sort of reconcile these two challenges? And I think, well, wait and see strategy is a good one. But we also see sort of escalation of, I would say, or radicalization of relations essentially between Tbilisi and Brussels. And well, essentially before the critical decision by the EU later this year whether to grant Georgia candidate status. So I think that there are mistakes. There are some good moves on foreign policy, in foreign policy realm. Overall, I think the abstention from imposing sanctions on Russia or sort of engaging very in a radical way against Russia and so on, that I think would not serve well not only Georgia, but also the West too. But in the longer run, whether this foreign policy extortion, which Georgia might be involved in, we still need to see whether it sort of brings results later this year. So essentially, we are seeing that Georgia is trying to show to the West, to the EU, that the country can expand its ties with other actors. And I think when we started our discussion, our ongoing discussion on China, or why the partnership was signed with China, I think that the reasoning behind that is not only China's interests, but also Georgia's interests, because of the timing of the partnership. I believe that that was done specifically at this exact moment, just because to show to the West that Georgia can actually rely on other actors. So it sort of tries to build sort of multi-vector foreign policy to be sort of multi-aligned, or whatever terms you want to use, and fashionable terms you want to use on that regard. But I strongly believe that the reasoning is somewhere there behind the partnership with China, that just to show that we can be with others too. So let's not make a wrong decision later this year.
So you're basically saying that in a way, Tbilisi is using the strategic partnership as a bargaining chip with the EU in a way. But don't you think that it's a bit of a dangerous game that can also backfire? In the EU, there are fears that this partnership could negatively impact Georgia's democratic processes. Should the EU be worried?
Yeah, oh, surely. I mean, when I explained the possible reasoning behind the signing of the partnership and sort of diplomatic extortion, that does not really mean that it's a guarantee, for success. Sure. So there, it could backfire, and it could succeed. It could backfire both ways, but it surely is a very sort of dangerous game, because you have to have tools to sort of successfully manage relations with, well, between big powers in a way that eventually it does not harm you. So you have to be as big as Turkey, or you have to have much bigger, I don't know, natural resources, or be even in a much more comfortable geographic position than Georgia is. So there are risks. And the thinking nowadays in Brussels, perhaps, is that Georgia is in a very difficult position. And if the candidate status is denied to Georgia for the second consecutive year, that might actually further distance the country from the West, from the EU. Surely there are numerous problems inside the country, political radicalization and the opposition and the ruling party. They have very different worldviews, essentially, on the problems inside the country or in foreign policy. And I think that the problems, economic problems, political problems the country now experiencing, those should not really be used as a reason for refusing the candidate status later this year, because there are much higher geopolitical costs in here for both, for Georgia and for the EU. So my belief is that if the EU thinks strategically, geopolitically, even geoeconomically, it should have Georgia closer to itself because of its very good, important position in terms of the expanding middle corridor, and so on and so on. So, and sort of Chinese moves and Russian moves into the South Caucasus. So from the EU perspective, Georgia should be under its fold. The alternative could be very grave, not only for Georgia, but for the EU. It will essentially lose the only route to the Caspian and the Central Asian region. And I'm not quite sure what will be an alternative to that, because the Russian route is essentially, I wouldn't say closed, but it's experiencing serious problems. So where would the EU go to reach essentially the Caspian Sea and Central Asia? So those are serious questions which the EU needs to consider before the decision later this year. But surely there is also not geopolitical but democratic questions and how the EU perceives Georgia's democratic development. I still believe that the country is not doing as bad as, let's say, others think, but nevertheless there are huge problems, and hopefully that this decision between either thinking democratic or in democratic terms or in geopolitical terms, those sort of would not hinder EU's right decision essentially later this year. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your analysis, Emil.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for your questions.
I have one last question. I ask all my guests for an advice for young China scholars.
I think I'm not going to say something super new on that front, but I believe that learning Chinese first of all, and reading books on history of China essentially, that would open the door to understanding the modern thinking of China. The perennial problem we are experiencing in the modern sort of studies of China, Russia, Iran, and other big countries across Eurasia, or any country essentially, is that people are focusing on the modern period, but you need to go back deeper into ancient and medieval period, because without that you will not be getting essential context. And that's, I think, what is missed even in the universities, and especially among scholars in very many think tanks across the world. So I think that is absolutely essential for us in order to understand China in a much better way.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
On that note, if you are a young professional or a student from Europe interested in China or China's relations with Europe, you can submit your latest work to Choice as part of our Future Choice initiative. For more information, check our website www.chinaobservers.eu. This was Voice for Choice. If you would like to know more about our work, please do visit our website at chinaobservers.eu. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. We hope you'll make the right choice and tune in for the next episode of Voice for Choice.